Emily said to herself, two more nights, and there would be a new moon in the sky, and she could prove the nasty, interfering old hag wrong. Had Semele chanced to turn and look back towards the river, she might have witnessed the extraordinary sight of that nasty, interfering old hag, now youthful, beautiful, magisterial, and imperious, rising up to the clouds in a purple and gold chariot drawn by a dozen peacocks. And had she the gift of second sight, Semele might have been granted a vision of the actual Beroe, innocent old nurse of the gods, living out her life miles away in respectable retirement on the coast of Phoenicia. The real Beroe, an Oceanid who had indeed nursed the young gods, gave her name to the city of Beirut. The Manifestation. The word for the appearance and revelation of a god to a mortal is theophany. It was with some impatience that on the night of the new moon, Semele paced up and down by the banks of the river Asopos, awaiting her lover. He arrived at last, this time as a stallion, black, glossy and fine, galloping through the fields towards her as the sun set in the west behind him, seeming to set his mane on fire. Oh, how she loved him! He let her stroke his flanks and palm his hot nostrils before he transformed himself into the shape she knew and loved so well. Hugging and holding him hard, she began to cry. "My darling girl," said Zeus, his finger running down to her belly, where it traced the outline of their child. "Not weeping again? What am I doing wrong?"
"You really are the god Zeus?"
"I am."
"Will you promise to grant any wish?"
"Oh, must you really?" said Zeus with a sigh.
It's nothing, not power or wisdom or jewels or anything like that, and I don't want you to destroy anyone. It's a small thing, really it is."
"Then," said Zeus, chucking her affectionately under the chin, "I will grant your wish."
"You promise?"
"I promise. I promise by this river. No, I've already sworn one thing by it. I shall promise you by the great Stygian stream itself." Raising his hand with mock solemnity, he intoned, "I swear by the sacred Styx, beloved Semele, that I will grant your next wish."
"Then," said Semele with a deep breath, "show yourself to me."
"How's that?"
"I want to see you as you really are, not as a man, but as a god, in your true divinity."
The smile froze on Zeus's face.
"No," he cried, "anything but that. Do not wish such a thing. No, no, no."
It was the tone of voice that gods often used when they realized they had been trapped into a rash promise. Apollo cried out in the same way, you will remember, when Phaeton called upon him to honor his oath. Suspicion flared up in Semele.
"You promised. You swore by the Styx. You swore. You swore an oath."
It was common, as you may remember from Apollo's promise to Phaeton, for gods to swear by this dark and hateful river.
"But, my darling girl, you don't know what you're asking. You swore!"
Semele actually stamped her foot. The god looked up at the sky and groaned. "I did. I pledged my word, and my word is sacred." As he spoke, Zeus began to gather himself into the form of a great thundercloud. From the center of this dark mass flashed the brightest light imaginable. Semele looked on, her face breaking into a broad and ecstatic smile of joy.
Only a god could change like this. Only Zeus himself could grow and grow with such bright fire and golden greatness. But the brightness was becoming so fierce, so terrible in the ferocity of its glare, that she threw up an arm to shade her eyes. Yet still the brilliance intensified, with a crack so loud that her ears burst and filled with blood. The brightness exploded in bolts of lightning that instantly struck the girl blind. Deaf and sightless, she staggered backwards, but too late to avoid the blazing force of a thunderbolt so powerful that it split her body open, killing her at once. Above him, around him, inside him, Zeus heard the triumphant laughter of his wife. Of course, he might have known. Somehow Hera had tricked this poor girl into forcing the awful promise from him. Well, she would not get their child. With a peal of thunder, Zeus returned to flesh and blood and plucked the fetus from Semele's belly. It was too young to breathe the air, so Zeus took a knife and sliced open his thigh and tucked the embryo inside. Holding it tight within this makeshift womb, Zeus knelt down to sew the child safely into his warm flesh. An astonishing story. As Ovid himself says, if man can believe this. The Newest God. 3 months later, Zeus and Hermes travelled to Nisus on the north coast of Africa, an area that lies, it is generally believed, somewhere between Libya and Egypt. There, Hermes cut open the stitching on Zeus's thigh and delivered him of a son, Dionysus. The infant was suckled by the rain nymphs of Nisus. A grateful Zeus rewarded them by adding them to the heavens as the Hyades, a spiral constellation whose rising and setting the Greeks believed presaged rain. Once weaned, Dionysus was tutored by pot-bellied Silenus, who was to become his closest companion and follower, a kind of Falstaff to the young god's Prince Hal. Silenus had his own train of followers too, the Silenae, satyr-like creatures forever associated with antic riot, rout, and revelry. It was as a youth that Dionysus made the discovery with which he will always be associated. He found out how to make wine from grapes. It is possible that Chiron, the centaur, taught him the trick, but another, more charming story tells of the young god's passionate love for a youth called Ampelos. Books 10, 11, and 12 of the sprawling 48-book epic poem The Dionysiaca by the Greek poet Nonnus of Panopolis details this relationship and its aftermath at great length. Dionysus was so besotted that he arranged all kinds of sporting contests between himself and Ampelos, always letting him win. This seems to have caused the boy to become rather spoilt, or at least reckless and foolhardy. Riding a wild bull one day, he made the error of boasting that he rode his horned steer more skillfully than the goddess Selene rode her horned moon. Choosing a punishment straight from Hera's vicious playbook, Selene sent a gadfly to sting the bull, which caused the maddened animal to throw and gore Ampelos. Dionysus rushed to the dying youth's mangled side, but he could not save him. Instead, he caused the dead and twisted body to transform magically into a winding, writhing, climbing plant, while the drops of blood solidified and swelled into luscious berries, whose skin shone with the bloom and luster the god had so admired. His lover had become a vine, which is still called Ampelos in Greece to this day. Dionysus produced the first vintage and drank the first draught of wine. This witchcraft, as it were, of turning the blood of Ampelos into wine became the god's gift to the world. Nonnus interrupts the action here, a thing he does a lot. His poem is astonishingly dull, given its superb subject matter, by having Eros come to comfort Dionysus with tales of other great male lovers. He tells of Calamos and Carpos, son of Zephyrus the Wind, and Chloris, nymph of greenery and new growth, as in chlorophyll and chlorine. Two beautiful youths, passionately in love with each other. During a swimming contest, athletics and hunting seems to be a theme with beautiful youths coming to a sticky end, as we shall see in the tales of Hyacinthus, Actaeon, Crocus, Adonis, amongst others. Carpos dies, and a desolated, grief-stricken Calamos commits suicide. Calamos is changed into reeds, and Carpos into fruit. They are the Greek words for reed and fruit to this day. A combination of the intoxicating effects of his invention and the enmity of Hera, whose hatred of any bastard of Zeus's, divine or otherwise, was always implacable, sent Dionysus mad for a while. To escape her curses, he spent the next few years travelling far and wide, spreading viticulture and the techniques of winemaking around the world. It is said that he gave the secrets of the vine to every known land except Britain and Ethiopia. It is sadly true that neither country has a great reputation for winemaking. Perhaps this explains it. In Assyria, Dionysus encountered the king and queen, Staphylos and Mithe, and their son Botrys. After a banquet in Dionysus's honour, Staphylos died of the first fatal hangover. As compensation, Dionysus named in their honour bunches of grapes, Staphylos, alcoholic liquid and drunkenness, Mithe, and the grape itself, Botrys. Science has taken these names and immortalized them in a way that splendidly exemplifies the continuing relationship between Greek myth and our language. When 19th-century microbiologists looked down their microscopes and saw a bacterium with a tail from which clusters of grape-like nodules sprouted, they called it Staphylococcus. Methylated spirits and methane take their names from Mithe. Botrytis, the noble rot fungus that benignly affects grapes on the vine, lending premium dessert wines their incomparable and shatteringly expensive bouquet, owes its name to Botrys. Throughout his adventures, the new god was accompanied not just by Silenus and his retinue of satyrs, but by an intense band of women followers too, the Maenads. The violent mysteries of these extreme worshippers were depicted in all their shocking savagery by the Athenian playwright Euripides in his play The Bacchae. In this bloody tragedy, Dionysus returns to Thebes to wreak his revenge on those of his mother's sisters who refused to believe Semele's claim to be carrying Zeus's child. The god sends King Pentheus mad and causes his bewitched aunts, Agave, Ino, and Autonoe, to tear the poor man apart, limb from limb. Dionysus was soon established as the god of wine, revelry, delirious intoxication, uninhibited dissipation, and the orgastic future. The Romans called him by the name Bacchus, and worshipped him quite as devotedly as did the Greeks. Dionysus was to stand in a kind of polar opposition to Apollo, one representing the golden light of reason, harmonious music, lyric poetry and mathematics, the other embodying the darker energies of disorder, liberation, wild music, bloodlust, frenzy, and unreason. Of course, the gods, having living personalities and stories, often strayed from such frozen symbolic identities. Apollo, as we shall see very soon, was himself capable of being bloody, crazed, and cruel, while Dionysus could be more than just the embodiment of inebriation and debauchery. He was sometimes called the Liberator, a vegetal life force whose license could benevolently relieve and renew the world. Ovid commonly uses the name Liber for him. It carries the sense of freedom and of libertine, as well as, unconnectedly, book. 13 at table. The vine leaf, the thyrsus with a pine cone on top, a chariot drawn by leopards or other exotic beasts, depraved attendants sporting roaring erections, jars flowing with wine. The Dionysiac idea added much to the world. The importance of this new god was such that he simply had to be welcomed into Olympus. But there was already a full complement of 12 gods in residence, and 13 was, even then, looked on as an unlucky number. The gods scratched their chins and wondered what could be done. They wanted Dionysus. The truth was, they liked him and the festive energy he brought to every gathering. And more than anything, they liked the idea of wine being added to nectar instead of fermented honey and plain fruit juice. "This comes at a perfect time," said Hestia, rising to her feet. "I feel more and more that I'm needed down in the world to help people and their families and to be present in the temples that celebrate the virtues of hearth, home, and hallway. Let young Bacchus take my place." There was an unconvincing murmur of protestation as Hestia stepped down, but she was insistent, and the exchange was made to the delight of all the gods, save one. Hera regarded Dionysus as Zeus's grossest insult to her. Apollo, Artemis and Athena were shameful enough as illegitimate additions to the dodecatheon, but that a bastard, half-human god should be admitted to heaven offended her to the core. She vowed always to abstain from Dionysus's poison drink and personally to shun the carousals with which he wrecked the peace and decorum of heaven. When Aphrodite gave birth to a son by Dionysus, Hera cursed the baby, whose name was Priapus, with ugliness and impotence, and had it cast down from Olympus. Priapus became the god of male genitalia and phalluses. He was especially prized by the Romans as the minor deity of the major boner, but deflation and disappointment were his fate. He went about in a constant state of excitement, which, on account of Hera's curse, always failed him when he tried to do anything about it. This chronic and embarrassing problem made it natural that he should be forever associated with alcohol, his father's gift to the world that ever provokes the desire but takes away the performance. Nonetheless, whether Hera liked it or not, Dionysus the twice-born, the only god to have a mortal human parent, rose to take his place now as a full member of the finally fixed Olympian 12. The Beautiful and the Damned. Angry Goddesses. Actaeon. The Cadmean house was one of the most important dynasties of the Greek world. As founder of Thebes and bringer of the alphabet, the role of Cadmus and his family was central in the making of Greece. But like many of the great houses, there was a curse attached to it. The killing of the water dragon allowed the city to be built, but it cast the curse of Ares over it too.
The Fates seldom allowed glory and triumph without the accompaniment of suffering and sorrow. Cadmus's daughter Autonoe had a son Actaeon by a minor god called Aristaeus, much venerated in Boeotia. Aristaeus is sometimes referred to as the Apollo of the fields. Like many of the later heroes, Actaeon was tutored and trained by the great and wise centaur Chiron. He grew up to become a much-admired huntsman and leader, renowned for his fearlessness in the chase and the skill and tender strength with which he handled his beloved hounds. One day, having lost the scent of an especially noble stag, Actaeon and his fellow huntsmen separated to pick up the trail. Stumbling through some bushes, Actaeon happened on a pool where Artemis was bathing. As she was the goddess of his favourite pursuit, hunting, Actaeon should have known better than to stare dumbstruck at her nakedness. She was also the fierce queen of celibacy, chastity, and virginity. But so beautiful was she, so much more lovely than any being Actaeon had ever beheld, that he stood rooted to the spot, his mouth open and his eyes, and not only his eyes, bulging. It may have been a twig snapping beneath his foot, it may have been the sound of Actaeon's drool hitting the ground, but something made Artemis turn. She saw a young man standing there, ogling, and her blood was fired. The thought of anyone spreading the word that they had seen her naked was so abhorrent to her that she called out, "You, mortal man, your staring is a profanity. I forbid you ever to speak. If you utter just one syllable, your punishment will be terrible. Indicate to me that you understand." The unhappy youth nodded. Artemis disappeared from view, and he was left alone to consider his fate. Behind him, a halloo started up as his fellow huntsmen announced that they were once more upon the scent. Instinctively, Actaeon called out. The moment he did so, Artemis's curse descended, and he was changed into a stag. The hunter hunted. Actaeon raised his head, now heavy with antlers, and galloped through the woods until he came to a pool of water. He looked down into the pool, and at the sight of himself gave what should have been a groan, but which came out as a mighty bellow. The bellow was answered by a great baying and yipping. Within seconds, his own pack of hounds had streamed into the clearing. They had been trained by Actaeon himself to rip out a stag's throat and feast on its steaming blood for their reward. As the yowling and snarling creatures leapt up at him, snapping their jaws, Actaeon raised his forelegs in the direction of Olympus, as if beseeching the gods for pity. They either did not hear or did not heed. In seconds, he was torn to pieces. If you want to impress your friends, you can learn this list of the male and female hounds, as given by Ovid. If nothing else, they might serve as useful names for online passwords. Dogs, Melampus, Icnobates, Pamphagos, Dorcius, Oribasos, Nebrophonos, Lilaps, Theron, Pterilas, Hylaeus, Lardon, Dromus, Tigris, Leucon, Asbolos, Lacon, Aello, Thuos, Harpalos, Menelaus, Labros, Arcus, Argiodus, Hylactor. Bitches, Agre, Nape, Pimenis, Hapaia, Canake, Stycte, Alce, Lysisse, Lacne, Melanchites, Therodomas, Orecitrophos. Erysichthon. The goddess Demeter is associated with fruitful abundance and the generous bounty of nature,
But if pushed beyond her usual forbearance, she could be as vengeful as Artemis, as this tale of her ruthless punishment of Erysichthon, king of Thessaly, clearly shows. In need of timber for the construction of new apartments in his palace, the bold, fearless, and impatient Erysichthon led a party of woodmen out to the forest, where they came upon a flourishing grove of oaks. "Excellent!" he cried. "Swing your axes, boys!" But his men drew back, muttering and shaking their heads. Erysichthon turned to his foreman. "What's the matter with them?"
"Those trees are sacred to Demeter, sire."
"Nonsense! She has more than she knows what to do with. Bring them down." More muttering. Erysichthon snatched the foreman's whip, which its owner only ever really waved for show, and cracked it menacingly over the heads of the foresters. "Chop those trees down or feel its sting," he cried. With their king cracking the whip and urging them on, the men reluctantly chopped down the trees. But when they came to a giant oak that stood alone at the end of the grove, they stopped again.
"Why, this is the tallest and broadest of them all," said Erysichthon. "That alone can provide timber for the rafters and columns of my throne room, and still leave enough over for a great bed for me."
The foreman pointed a trembling finger at the oak's branches, which were hung with garlands.
The king was unimpressed.
"And?"
"My lord," whispered the foreman, "each wreath stands for a prayer that the goddess has answered."
"If the prayers have already been answered, she will have no need of flower arrangements. Cut it down." But seeing that the foreman and his men were too afraid to proceed, the impetuous Erysichthon snatched up an axe and set about it himself. He was a strong man, and like most rulers, he loved to show off his will, skill, and sinew. It was not long before the trunk creaked and the mighty oak began to sway. Did Erysichthon hear the plaintive cries of a hamadryad in the boughs? If he did, he paid no heed, but swung his axe again and again until down crashed the tree, branches, votive wreaths, garlands, hamadryad and all. As the oak died, so died its hamadryad. With her last breath, she cursed Erysichthon for his crime. Demeter heard of Erysichthon's sacrilege and sent word to Limos. Limos was one of the vile creatures that had flown from Pandora's jar. She was a demon of famine who might be regarded as Demeter's inverse, the goddess's necessary opposite in the mortal world. One, the fecund and bountiful herald of the harvest, the other, the mercilessly cruel harbinger of hunger and blight. Since the two existed in an irreconcilable matter-antimatter relationship, they could never meet in person. So Demeter sent a nymph of the mountains as her envoy to urge Limos to deliver the Hamadryad's curse on Erysichthon, a task the malevolent demon was only too happy to undertake. Limos had, according to Ovid, rather let herself go, with sagging, withered breasts, an empty space for a stomach, exposed rotten bowels, sunken eyes, crusted lips, scaly skin, lank, scurfy hair, and swollen, pustular ankles, the face and figure of famine presented a haunting and dreadful spectacle. Limos stole that night into Erysichthon's bedroom, took the sleeping king in her arms, and breathed her foul breath into him. Her poison fumes seeped into his mouth, throat, and lungs. Through his veins and into every cell of his body slid the terrible, insatiable worm of hunger. Erisichthon awoke from strange dreams, feeling very, very peckish. He surprised his kitchen staff with an enormous breakfast order. He consumed every morsel, yet still his appetite was unsated. All day he found that the more he ate, the more ravenous he became. As days and then weeks passed, the pangs of hunger gnawed deeper and deeper. No matter how much he consumed, he could never be satisfied nor gain so much as an ounce of weight. Food inside him acted like fuel on a fire, causing the hunger to burn ever more fiercely. For this reason, his people began referring to him behind his back as Ethon, which means burning. He was, perhaps, the first man ever to eat himself out of house and home. One by one, all his treasure and possessions and even his palace were sold off to buy food. But still this wasn't enough, for nothing could appease his colossal appetite. At last he was reduced to selling his daughter Mestra to raise money to quieten the remorseless demands of his unassuageable appetite. This was a more cunning and less barbarous act than perhaps it sounds. The beautiful Mestra had once been a lover of Poseidon's, who had rewarded her with the ability to alter her shape at will, a power in the especial gift of the god of the ever-changing sea. Every week, Erisichthon would offer his daughter to a rich suitor and accept the bride money. Mestra would accompany her fiancé to his home, escape in the shape of one animal or another, and return to Erisichthon, ready to be sold again to a fresh, gullible suitor. Even this arrangement proved insufficient to tamp down the dreadful flames of hunger, and in desperation one day, he chewed off his left hand. The arm followed, then his shoulder, feet, and hams. Before long, King Erisichthon of Thessaly had eaten himself all up. Demeter and the Hamadryad were avenged. The Doctor and the Crow. The Birth of Medicine. There was once an intensely attractive young princess called Coronis from the Thessalian kingdom of Phlegyantis. So great was her beauty that she caught the attention of the god Apollo, who took her as a lover. You might think that the companionship and love of the most beautiful of the gods would be enough for anyone, but Coronis, while pregnant with Apollo's child, fell for the charms of a mortal called Ischys and slept with him. One of Apollo's white crows witnessed this act of betrayal and flew back to tell his master all about the insult to his honor. Enraged, Apollo asked his sister Artemis to take revenge. Only too willing, she attacked the palace at Phlegyantis with plague arrows, poisoned darts that spread a terrible disease throughout the compound. Many besides Coronis were infected. The crow saw all and returned to give Apollo a full report. "She's dying, my lord, dying." Did she say anything? Did she admit her guilt?
Oh yes, I deserve my fate," she said. "Tell the great god Apollo that I ask no forgiveness and beg no pity, only save the life of our child, save the life of our child."
With such malicious glee did the crow crow that Apollo lost his temper and turned it black. All crows, ravens and rooks ever since have been that colour. Although on a BBC adaptation of the Gormenghast books, I worked with an albino crow called Jimmy White. When Apollo, now filled with remorse, reached plague-stricken Phlegyantis, he found Coronis lying dead on her funeral pyre. the flames licking all round her. With a cry of grief, he leapt through the flames and from her womb cut out their child, who was still living. Coronis was raised to the stars as the constellation Corvus, the crow. Coronis is a Greek word for crow or rook. Its original meaning is curved, whether in reference to the curves of the princess or of the bird's beak, I cannot say. The rescued infant boy, whom Apollo named Asclepius, was put in the care of the centaur Chiron. Perhaps because he had been delivered by a surgical procedure, albeit a rather violent one, perhaps because while he had been in the womb, infection had raged all around him, perhaps because his father was Apollo, god of science, probably for all these reasons, Asclepius demonstrated early on some very remarkable talents in the field of medicine. As the boy grew, it quickly became clear to Chiron that he allied an incisive, logical, and curious mind with a natural gift for healing. Chiron, no mean naturalist, herbalist, and reasoner himself, took enormous pleasure in training the boy in the medical arts. Besides giving him a thorough grounding in the anatomy of animals and humans, he taught him that knowledge is gained from observation and careful record-keeping, rather than from spinning theories. He showed him how to gather medicinal plants, grind them, mix them, heat them, and work them into powders, potions, and preparations that could be eaten, drunk, or stirred into food. He instructed him how to staunch blood flow, concoct fermented poultices, dress wounds, and reset fractured bones. By the time he was 14, he had saved a soldier's leg from being amputated, brought a fevered young girl back from the very brink of death, rescued a bear from a trap, saved the population of a village from an epidemic of dysentery, and relieved the suffering of a bruised snake by the application of an ointment of his own devising. This last case proved to be invaluable, for the grateful serpent had licked Asclepius's ear in thanks, whispering as he did so many secrets of the arts of healing that were closed even to Chiron. Athena, to whom snakes were sacred, bestowed her thanks too, in the form of a jar of Gorgon's blood. You might think this a poor gift. Far from it. Sometimes the law of opposites applies. A single drop of the silvery gold ichor that keeps the gods immortal is fatal for humans to touch or taste. The blood of a creature as deadly and dangerous as a serpent-haired gorgon, on the other hand, has the power to bring the dead back to life. By the time he was 20, Asclepius had mastered all the arts of surgery and medicine. He embraced his teacher Chiron in a fond farewell and left to set up on his own as the world's first physician, apothecary, and healer. His fame spread around the Mediterranean world with great speed. The sick, lame, and unhappy flocked to his surgery, outside which he hung a sign, a wooden staff with a snake twined round it, seen to this day on many ambulances, clinics, and often disreputable medical websites. Some use the staff of Asclepius, or Hippocratic staff, a rough wooden stick entwined with a single serpent. Others use the Caduceus of Hermes, a more slender and elegant staff entwined by two serpents whose heads meet at the top and are surmounted by a pair of wings. There does not seem to be any professional or clinical significance in the choice. It is purely a matter of preference. Asclepius married Epione, whose name means soothing or relief from pain. Together they had three sons and four daughters. Asclepius trained his girls as rigorously as Chiron had trained him. The eldest, Hygieia, he taught the practices of cleanliness, diet, and physical exercise that are today named hygiene after her. To Panacea, he revealed the arts of universal health, of medicinal preparation, and the production of remedies and treatments that could heal anything, which is what her name means, cure-all. Acesso, he instructed in the healing process itself, including what we would now call immunology. The youngest girl, Yasso, specialized in recovery and recuperation. The elder boys, Machaon and Podalirius, became prototypes of the army doctor. Their later service in the Trojan War was recorded by Homer. The youngest son, Telesphorus, is usually depicted as being hooded and of very restricted growth. His field of study was rehabilitation and convalescence, the return of a patient to full health. All might have gone well had Asclepius kept tightly sealed the jar that Athena presented to him. Tightly sealed. Whether it was the glory of being celebrated as a kind of saint and saviour, or whether it was a genuine desire to beat death with his arts, we cannot know. But Asclepius used the Gorgon's blood once to revive the corpse of a dead patient, then a second time, and soon he was using it as liberally and regularly as castor oil. Hades began to grumble and fume. Unable to bear it any longer, he went so far as to leave the underworld and stand angrily before the throne of his brother, Zeus. "This man is denying me souls. He pulls them back from Thanatos, just as they are ready to cross over to us. Something must be done."
"I agree," said Hera. "He is subverting the proper order of things. If a person is marked down for death, it is quite unacceptable for a mortal to interfere. Your daughter did a very foolish thing in giving him Gorgon's blood."
Zeus frowned. There was no denying the truth of what they said. He was disappointed in Athena. She had not betrayed him in so flagrant and unforgivable a manner as Prometheus, but there were points of similarity that troubled him. Mortals were mortal, and that was that. Allowing them access to potions that gave them ascendancy over death was quite wrong. The thunderbolt which struck Asclepius was wholly unexpected, as bolts from the blue always are. It killed him stone dead. All of Greece lamented the loss of their beloved and valued physician and healer, but Apollo did more than mourn the passing of his son. He raged. As soon as he heard the news, he took himself off to the workshop of Hephaestus and with three swift arrows shot dead Brontes, Steropes, and Arges, the Cyclopes, whose eternal task and pleasure it was to manufacture the Sky Father's thunderbolts. Such astounding rebelliousness was not to be brooked. Zeus was intolerant of any threat to his authority and always moved swiftly to put down the slightest hint of insurrection. Apollo was thrown from Olympus and commanded to serve the Thessalian king Admetus in a lowly position for a year and a day. Admetus had earned the approval of Zeus by his exceptionally warm hospitality and kindness to strangers, always a direct route to Zeus's heart. Apollo had been punished when young, you will recall, for slaying the serpent Python. His beauty, splendour, and golden charm hid a stubborn will and a hot temper. He submitted to this punishment readily enough, however. Admetus was impossible to dislike. The 3rd century BC poet and scholar Callimachus suggests that Apollo and Admetus became enthusiastic lovers during this period of servitude. Serving as his cowherd, Apollo ensured that every cow under his care gave birth to twins, cattle and twins were special to him. Asclepius, meanwhile, was raised to the heavens as the constellation Ophiuchus, the serpent-bearer. Later traditions asserted that Zeus restored Asclepius to life and raised him up as a god. It is true that throughout the Mediterranean world, he and his wife and daughters were worshipped as divine. Temples to him, known as Asclepia, sprang up everywhere, bearing great similarities to modern spas and health clubs. Their officiating priests wore white and bathed, massaged, and pampered the paying supplicants with preposterous oils, creams, and patent mixtures, just as they do today. Ever sacred to Asclepius, snakes, the non-venomous kind, were encouraged to slither about the treatment rooms and clinics, a sight perhaps less common in our contemporary temples to health. The spirit and mind were attended to then as they are now. Holistic is, after all, a Greek word. Dreams were told to priests on the morning after an overnight stay, known as an incubation, and Asclepius himself often manifested to patients, especially, I believe, to those who paid the most. The Asclepian of Epidaurus was as big a draw in the great days of Athens as the town's celebrated theatre is today. Those who visit it can still see records of the illnesses, treatments, diets, and cures of the patients who flocked there. Crime and punishment. The regular appearance, interference, and intercourse of the gods in human society, which would be so remarkable and thrilling to us if it happened today, was sometimes taken for granted by the more foolish and self-important mortals of the Silver Age. Some kings were so puffed up that they ignored the most elementary precepts of the gods and exhibited the most flagrant disrespect towards them. Such blasphemous acts of lèse majesté seldom went unpunished. Like parents admonishing children with gruesome moral fables, or like Dante or Hieronymus Bosch with their cautionary hellscapes, the ancient Greeks seemed to relish the details and delightful aptness of the often elaborate and excruciating tortures that Olympus and Hades reserved for those men and women whose transgressions most aggravated them. Ixion. There was no graver sin in Zeus's eyes than the betrayal of Xenia, the sacred duty of hosts towards guests and guests towards hosts. Few mortals showed more contempt for its principles than Ixion, king of the Lapiths, an ancient tribe from Thessaly. His first crime was one of simple greed. We are familiar with the idea of dowries, the practice of families of prospective brides paying to have their daughters taken off their hands. In ancient Greece, things were done the other way around. Prospective husbands paid the bride's family for the right to marry their daughter. Ixion wed the beautiful Dia, but refused to pay her father, King Deioneus of Phocis, the agreed bride price. In retaliation, the affronted Deioneus sent a raiding party to take a herd of Ixion's best horses. Hiding his vexation beneath a wide smile, Ixion invited Deioneus to dinner at his palace in Larissa. When he arrived, Ixion pushed him into a fiery pit. This flagrant breach of the rules of hospitality was trumped by the even grosser sin of blood-killing. The slaying of a family member was considered a taboo of the most heinous kind. With this action, Ixion had committed one of the first blood murders, and unless he was cleansed of his transgression, the Furies would pursue him until he went mad. The princes, lords, and neighbouring landowners of Thessaly had cause to dislike Ixion, and none offered to perform the catharsis, the ritual process of purification that would redeem him. The king of the gods, though, was in a surprisingly forgiving mood. The people of Thessaly had acted quickly to show their revulsion at Ixion's double crime of Xenia abuse and kin-slaying. Zeus was minded to be merciful. He not only released Ixion from his torment, but went so far as to invite him to a banquet on Olympus. Such an honour was rare for mortals. The glamour and grandeur of an Olympian feast were beyond anything Ixion would have seen before. He was especially bowled over by the queenly beauty of Hera. Whether it was the intoxicating effects of the great occasion or the wine, nobody could afterwards decide. Perhaps it was nothing more than congenital boorish idiocy, but far from behaving with the modest gratitude you might expect of any mortal invited to the immortal dinner table, Ixion committed the catastrophic error of trying to seduce the Queen of Heaven. He blew Hera kisses, winked at her, tried to nibble her ear, whispered lewd remarks, and made concerted grabs at her breasts. He not only insulted the most dignified and proper of the Olympians, but he once more transgressed the laws of Xenia. Failing in the duties of a guest was considered as heinous as failing in the duties of a host. After Ixion had staggered down from Olympus, slapping backs and belching out thanks, an offended Hera told Zeus of the outrage upon her honour. Zeus was equally incensed. He decided to lay a trap for Ixion. The cloud gatherer gathered a cloud and sculpted it into an anatomically exact and fully working likeness of Hera. He blew on it, animating it into life, and sent it down to a meadow outside Larissa, where Zeus had seen Ixion sprawled asleep on the grass, snoring off the effects of the banquet. When Ixion awoke to find Hera beside him, he rolled over and coupled with her there and then. At the sight of this unspeakable blasphemy, Zeus sent down a thunderbolt and a fiery wheel. The thunderbolt blasted Ixion into the air and pinned him to the wheel, which Zeus sent spinning across the heavens. In time, the firmament was deemed too good for him, and Ixion, bound to his wheel of fire, was sent down to Tartarus, where he revolves, spread-eagled and roasting in agony, to this very day. The Hera cloud was given the name Nephele. Her union with Ixion produced a son, Centaurus, an ugly and misshapen boy who grew into a lonely and unhappy man who took his pleasure not with humans, but with the wild mares of Mount Pelion, where he liked to roam. The untamable and savage progeny of this unnatural union between man and horse were named after him centaurs. Only one such equine-human hybrid had been seen on Earth before, the great Chiron, tutor to Asclepius, Achilles, and many others. Chiron's birth could be traced back to the time of Cronos, son of Uranus and Gaia, father of Zeus and Hera. During a lull in the Titanomachy, Cronos fell for Philyra, an Oceanid of great beauty. She repelled his advances until, tiring of her bashfulness, he transformed himself into a great black stallion and took her against her will. Chiron was the offspring of this union, and, despite predating Centaurus by many hundreds of years, he is referred to as a centaur by convention. Consequences. Many of the Greek myths lead to cascades of consequences. As we have already seen, leading figures in one story will go on to marry and found dynasties from whom are born legendary heroes. And there are plenty of subsidiary myths that spin off from the Wheel of Ixion. While on the subject of Mount Pelion, for example, it is worth mentioning the story of Iphimedea, who was so in love with Poseidon that she would regularly sit by the shore, scooping up seawater and pouring it over her breasts and into her lap. Poseidon was touched by this show of adoration and swept out of the ocean in an embracing wave to conjoin with her. Twin sons were born, Otus and Ephialtes. They were true giants in our modern sense. As boys, they grew by the breadth of a human hand every month. It was clear that when they reached manhood, they would be the largest beings alive. As you will recall, the jealous and ambitious Poseidon had always kept in mind the possibility that one day his younger brother Zeus might slip up and be toppled from his throne. The sea god put in the heads of his fast-growing boys the idea of challenging heaven by creating their own mountain from which to rule the world. Their plan was to pull up Mount Ossa and heap it on Olympus. On top of Ossa, they would pile Mount Pelion. But before the twins had grown to the full height and strength necessary to achieve this, word reached Zeus of the possibility of their rebellion, and Apollo was sent to fell them with arrows. Their punishment in the underworld was to be bound to pillars by writhing snakes. Just to run the thread of the narrative right through to one of its conclusions, and as a further example of how one story could lead on to other, even more significant and far-reaching myths, you should know that Nephele, the cloud image of Hera, went on to marry a Boeotian king called Athamas, by whom she bore two sons, Phrixus and Helle. She had cause to save the life of Phrixus when, an Isaac to his father's Abraham, Athamas tied his son to the ground and made to sacrifice him. Just as the Hebrew god revealed a ram in a thicket to Abraham and saved Isaac's life, so Nephele sent a golden ram to rescue her son Phrixus. The golden fleece of that ram gave rise to the great quest of Jason and his Argonauts, all on account of a drunken, degenerate king who had the temerity to make eyes at Hera. The Wheel of Ixion became a popular subject for artists and sculptors, and the phrase, a wheel of fire, is sometimes used to describe an agonizing burden, punishment, or duty. Shakespeare's King Lear cries out, "Thou art a soul in bliss, but I am bound upon a wheel of fire that mine own tears do scald like molten lead." The expression to pile Pelion on Ossa is seen too, meaning to add difficulty to difficulty. Tantalus. Perhaps the best-known torment the gods ever devised is that which was dreamt up for the wicked king Tantalus. The consequences of his crimes had ramifications that rang down through the years. The curse upon his house was not lifted until the very end of the mythic age. Tantalus ruled Lydia in western Asia Minor, the region later known as the Turkish province of Anatolia. Mineral deposits from nearby Mount Sipylus had yielded him enormous riches, from which he established a prosperous city, which he immodestly called Tantalus. He married Dione, one of the Hyades, or rain nymphs who suckled the infant Dionysus, and by her had a son, Pelops, and a daughter, Niobe. There was another son, Brotias, who liked to hunt and whose life seems to have been uneventful compared to that of his siblings. He is said to have carved a figure of Cybele, the Anatolian mother god, into the rock of Mount Sipylus. Parts of it are still visible to the tourist today. Either there was a kink in Tantalus's personality, or his power and wealth had fooled him into believing himself equal to the gods. Like Ixion before him, he made the mistake of abusing Zeus's hospitality, in his case by returning from a banquet on Olympus with stolen ambrosia and nectar in his pockets. He also committed the unpardonable solecism of telling tales about the private lives and mannerisms of the gods, amusing his courtiers and friends with insolent mimicry and gossip. But then he committed a blood murder, one even worse than Ixion's crime of casting his father-in-law into a pit of burning coals. Hearing that the Olympians were furious at his mockery and the theft of their nectar and ambrosia, he made a great show of repentance and begged that they accept his own hospitality in recompense for his misconduct. Now, all of this took place around the time Demeter was searching for her abducted daughter Persephone. In her grief, she had allowed all growing things to wither and die. The world was barren and infertile, and no one knew how long this would last. The prospect of a feast came as a welcome excitement. Knowing of the opulent and ostentatious lifestyle of King Tantalus, the gods were greatly looking forward to the legendary pleasures of his table. They were in for a shock. The Olympians may have subsisted on ambrosia and nectar, but they took great delight in the variety offered by mortal diets, too. As the Pelasgian king Lycaon had done before him, Tantalus served up his own son to the gods. The young Pelops was killed, jointed, roasted, slathered in a rich sauce, and set before them. They sensed instantly that something was wrong and declined to eat. But Demeter, whose mind was wholly on her lost daughter, distractedly picked at and ate the boy's left shoulder. When Zeus understood what had happened, he summoned one of the three fates, Clotho the spinner. She collected the body parts, stirred them in a great cauldron, and put them back together. Demeter, awakened to her dreadful lapse, commissioned Hephaestus to carve a shoulder from ivory to replace the one she had consumed. Clotho attached the prosthetic, which fitted perfectly. Zeus breathed into the boy's body, and Pelops stirred back into life. Pelops' great beauty attracted Poseidon, and for a while they became lovers. Yet darker forces were at work with the youth, and his later life and deeds called down a curse upon him and all his house, named by historical convention the House of Atreus after one of his sons. Compounded with the curse earned by the abominable crime of Tantalus, this curse was to pursue his descendants down to the last of their line, Orestes. Tantalus himself was dispatched straight to Tartarus and punished in a manner befitting one who dared tempt the gods into eating the fruit of a monstrous blood crime. He was placed in a pool of water up to his waist. Above his head waved the bough of a tree from which hung luscious and appetizing fruits. Hunger and thirst raged within him, but every time he stretched up to take a bite, the branch would swing out of his reach. Every time he stooped to drink, the waters of the pool would shrink back to deny him. He could not move away, for above him, threatening to crush him if he dared try to escape, hovered a great stone of the hard blue-grey element that would one day be called tantalum. Tantalum is one of those refractory metals that is essential these days in the manufacture of many of our electronic devices. There Tantalus stands to this day, agonizingly close to satisfaction, but always denied it, enacting the tortured frustration that bears his name, tantalized, but never satisfied, until the end of time. A tantalus is a small cabinet containing two or three drinks decanters, usually of brandy, whiskey or rum. The drinks are on display, but the cabinet is locked and thus tantalizingly out of the reach of the children of the household. Sisyphus, brotherly love. The eternal punishment Sisyphus endures in Hades has also entered language and lore, but there is much more to his story than the famous stone he is doomed endlessly and fruitlessly to push uphill. Sisyphus was a wicked, greedy, duplicitous, and often cruel man, but who cannot find something appealing, heroic even, in the unquenchable zest and fist-shaking defiance with which he lived, in fact, outlived, his life. Few mortals dared to try the patience of the gods in so reckless a fashion. His foolhardy contempt and refusal to apologize or conform put one in mind of a Grecian Don Giovanni. Deucalion and Pyrrha, the survivors of the Great Flood, had had a son named Helen, after whom the Greeks to this day call themselves Hellenes. Helen's son, Aeolus, had four sons, Sisyphus, Salmoneus, Athamas, and Cretheus. Sisyphus and Salmoneus hated each other with as visceral and implacable a hatred as the human world had yet witnessed. Rivals in their parents' affections, rivals in everything, from